and so forth. According to a September report by the Iran Computer and Video Games Foundation, there were at least 32 million gamers among Iran's population of 80 million, and that number is growing every day. Industry insiders say that with the increasing number of gamers in Iran, domestic video game companies are growing constantly. Currently, Iran has over 150 game development companies. The gaming industry has seen rapid developments and grown from $59 billion to a staggering $160 billion back in 2020. The global gaming industry is now worth more than $300 billion. There are 2.9 billion players active worldwide. The trend seems to be growing and taking the gaming sector to new highs, making it one of the most lucrative industries on the planet.
Almost out of time for this program, but before we go, let's briefly check out some news and trends in the ICT sector. As the pandemic is more or less under control, Iran is gearing up to welcome tourists again with the help of virtual and augmented reality services.
Five Iranian knowledge-based companies have been working on these services to promote inbound tourism. They have successfully developed platforms for virtual tours of museums and historical sites and so much more. One platform incorporates augmented reality, which reconstructs Persepolis, allowing its users to visit the landmark using their smartphones or tablets.
If you are interested in the goings-on of the stock market, this next bit of news is just for you. Several startups developed in the ICT sector are planning to go public and offer their shares in the stock market.
Startups in cap-hailing services, popular video-on-demand platforms, and Iran's largest Android app store, among many more, have all applied. Previously, many startups wanting to join Bourse have been facing obstacles. However, Iran Fara Bourse has removed some of these barriers, making it easier for them to offer shares. It has set up a special framework that requires startups to share mutual funds instead of the popular book-building method. The government has been supporting tech firms and startups aiming at further developing the tech ecosystem.
That covers our program on information communications technologies and their markets in the country. Don't forget to leave us your feedback. Thank you for tuning in.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
UK household incomes are on course to collapse by the most since the mid-1970s, after a Russia-Ukraine conflict sent energy prices soaring to new highs, a think tank has said. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's economics correspondent Richard Partington. The piece is titled UK Household Incomes Facing Biggest Decline Since Mid-70s, says think tank. UK household incomes are on course to collapse by the most since the mid-1970s, after a Russia-Ukraine conflict sent energy prices soaring to new highs, a think tank has said. The Resolution Foundation, a think tank, said the dramatic increase in global oil and gas prices was forecast to push UK inflation above 8% this spring, causing average income across Britain to fall by 4% in the coming financial year. A hit worth £1,000 per household, the biggest annual decline since 1975. Warning the Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, that urgent steps were required to help the poorest families in Britain with soaring living costs, the think tank said weak wage growth and high inflation were expected to drive more children into poverty in Britain. Inflation in the United Kingdom was already at 5.5%, the highest rate for 30 years, before the Russia-Ukraine conflict erupted. Now economists are warning that the conflict's impact on global oil and gas prices will add to inflationary pressures around the world. Although the UK sources relatively little of its gas supply from Russia, about 5% of its total imports of natural gas come from Russia, fears over supply restrictions amid the escalating conflict have driven up global wholesale prices. Oil prices surged to $139 a barrel on Monday, 7th of March 2022, before falling back to about $125 a barrel. UK gas prices rose to 800 pence a therm before falling to about 600 pence, still almost triple the price at the start of February. The Resolution Foundation said UK inflation could therefore peak at 8.3% this spring, or even exceed the 8.4% rate of April of 1991, which was the highest level for the measure of the increasing cost of living since 1982. It said the damage for household incomes could have been bigger without the £350 boost provided by the government's energy support package announced last month. Without taking this into account, analysts at the Bank of America last week had forecast the biggest drop in living standards in Britain since at least 1956. The warning comes as the government prepares to increase the value of working age benefits and the state pension by 3.1% from April. Over the course of this year, the Resolution Foundation estimated this would mean a real terms cut in the value of benefits of more than £10 billion. The think tank, Resolution Foundation, said Chancellor Rishi Sunak needed to take evasive action to protect households from the squeeze. Adam Corlett, the principal economist at the Resolution Foundation, said, "The immediate priority should be for the Chancellor to revisit benefits uprating in his upcoming spring statement." The Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, has come under increasing pressure in recent days to use his mini-budget to address the economic impact of the conflict at home and abroad, including from backbench Conservative MPs urging a rise in defense spending and trade unions calling for more humanitarian aid for Ukraine and support for British workers. Tom Keating, the director of the Center for Financial Crime and Security Studies at the Royal United Services Institute, told MPs on the Treasury Committee on Monday that Chancellor Rishi Sunak needed to provide an urgent update. Tom Keating said, "I would like to hear from the Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, about how is he thinking about the impact of sanctions on the UK economy. It's clearly a massive issue for Britain, so it will be good to hear how are the thoughts around dealing with cost of living crisis. How is that being thought through? I think communicating that soon would be important," he said. Meanwhile, Britain's retail industry bosses are warning that the squeeze on living standards would hit consumer spending this year, weighing down Britain's economic recovery from COVID-19 pandemic. The British Retail Consortium said on Tuesday total sales rose in February by 6.7% compared with the same month a year earlier, and by 4.9% compared with the same month in 2020, before the pandemic struck, as shoppers returned to the high street after the government relaxed COVID restrictions introduced during the Omicron wave. However, Helen Dickinson, the chief executive of the British Retail Consortium, said, "Sales would soon come under pressure. The future is looking increasingly uncertain, with current demand unlikely to be sustained," she said. "The cost of living will continue to spiral due to global inflation, increasing energy bills and a rise in national insurance contributions this spring. With households facing lower disposable income, discretionary spend will be one of the first things to feel the squeeze." A government spokesperson said, "We recognise the pressures people are facing now with the cost of living, which is why we're providing support worth around £20 billion this financial year and next to help."
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
A U.S. delegation of senior State Department and White House officials traveled to the Venezuelan capital, Caracas, to meet with President Nicolas Maduro's government. The meeting is the highest-level visit by U.S. officials to Venezuela in years. It also coincides with an ongoing conflict between Russia and Ukraine. The question is, why should such a meeting take place at this time? Venezuela and the U.S. severed all diplomatic relations in 2019 following Washington's recognition of pro-U.S. opposition leader Juan Guaido as Venezuela's interim president over the legitimate president Nicolas Maduro. The U.S. then imposed sanctions on individuals with ties to Maduro's government and on companies involved in exporting Venezuelan oil to provoke regime change in the Latin American country. Venezuela soon felt the impact of sanctions as its oil production reduced significantly. In response, Caracas turned to Russia, as well as Iran and China, for diplomatic and economic aid. Russian energy companies and banks have since played a major role in Venezuela's exporting of oil. Fast forward to today, Russia is involved in a conflict with Ukraine. Russian President Vladimir Putin says he will only halt his country's military operation if Ukraine is stopped fighting and if Moscow's demands are met. On the other hand, Western governments have targeted Russia with a barrage of sanctions. The U.S. has imposed a ban on the exports of specific technologies to its oil refinery sector. Washington has also blacklisted over a dozen of Russian entities with ties to the country's military and defense sectors. Meanwhile, European Union has excluded seven Russian banks from the global SWIFT payment system. The bloc has also banned two major news networks, namely Russia Today and Sputnik. And Germany has decided to freeze the Nord Stream 2 project. In a bid to punish Russia for attacking Ukraine, the US and its allies targeted Moscow's oil and gas sector via sanctions. And countries like Venezuela are potential substitutes. In addition, while the war in Ukraine continues unabated, Washington is paying closer attention to Moscow's allies in Latin America. Current and former US officials believe that's because Washington thinks they could become security threats if the standoff with Russia deepens.
The U.S. is going to try to divide Russia from Latin America and the Caribbean. And interestingly enough, according to the White House itself, a lot of the sanctions imposed on Russia over this whole Ukraine nonsense are designed to target Venezuela, Cuba, and Nicaragua, because those countries are also sanctioned by the U.S. And those countries are also dependent on Russia for aid. Russian support and aid is one of the main reasons why these countries have been able to overcome the sanctions to begin with. So in a sense, the U.S. is targeting these countries indirectly by hitting Russia, and I think people are not going to fall for it.
In a public speech on Thursday, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro stated that his country is open to discussing oil deals with investors from all around the world, including the U.S. In case Washington restricts the imports of Russian oil, Venezuela would be able to replace some of the lost supplies. The U.S. sees Latin America as an opportunity to advance its agenda among Latin American countries allied with Russia. But the U.S. is not that popular in Latin America for many reasons. In slightly less than 100 years, from 1898 to 1994, the U.S. intervened successfully to change governments in Latin America at least 41 times, or once every 28 months for an entire century.
The U.S. has launched a number of military coups to try to overthrow the left-wing government in Venezuela. It has used all diplomatic and sanction means to try to do so. None of this has worked because the Venezuelan government has the backing of the people and also internationally has the support of countries like Russia, Iran, China, Nicaragua, Cuba, and many others that stand in solidarity with the Venezuelan government.
The United States has long interfered in the internal affairs of Nicaragua, a Latin American country it once occupied from 1912 to 1933 as part of the Banana Wars. Washington has imposed sanctions against Nicaragua's government and president Daniel Ortega's inner circle since 2018 when protests erupted in the country. Meanwhile, Cuba suffers from chronic shortages of electricity and food exacerbated by brutal U.S. sanctions. It also holds Washington responsible for stirring up violence in the country and blames its economic woes mainly on U.S. embargoes. And there is a long list of other countries in the region that have been victims of the U.S. sanctions and its intervention in their domestic affairs. While Washington seeks to find a substitute oil producer to fill in the place of Russia to further pressure Moscow by imposing stricter sanctions on its oil and gas, U.S.'s dark history continues to haunt it. Will Putin's Latin American allies stay loyal to him, or will they forget all hardship the U.S. has inflicted on their people for years? The Western media's portrayal of Ukraine's suffering is somehow different compared to those suffering from wars in other countries like Yemen, Libya, Ethiopia, Palestine, and Syria has sparked widespread criticism. News coverage of civilian Ukrainians defending their country, by making Molotov cocktails and arming themselves with the state-given machine guns has also been celebrated as heroic, and these people have been called freedom fighters. This empathy has not been voiced for others, like Palestinians who experience an identical crisis, yet are labeled terrorists when defending their land. The suffering in Ukraine must be highlighted. However, portraying Ukraine's pain as more human shows the deep hypocrisy at play. Now, the West has come under criticism over what is seen as double standards regarding conflicts in other parts of the world.
You're happy to correctly use the most strong and robust language to describe the crimes against humanity of Vladimir Putin, but you will not use the same strength of language when it comes to describing the Israel's treatment of the Palestinians, when it is now being documented and detailed by two of the most respected human rights organizations in the world, and indeed has been alleged by dozens and dozens of non-governmental organizations, and to be honest, anybody who looks honestly.
Barrett asked whether the Irish Parliament will impose sanctions against Israel. He also asked whether the Irish legislative body would support calls for referring Israel to international courts over its crimes against humanity. This is not the first time the Western media has shown its bias. A similar narrative was pushed against Palestinians last year. Israel's decades-long occupation, its crippling blockade and military grip over Palestinians, as well as a wave of demolitions, led to a two-week war that killed around 260 Palestinians and 13 Israelis. News outlets and political figures spoke out on the conflict, but it started with the opposite end of the story, starting with Palestinian reactions and violence. While Israel was the real aggressor, they focused on rockets fired by the Hamas resistance movement that came later in retaliation. The double standards of the US and the West are the focal point of tension, violence, and bloodshed, and make Washington an unacceptable mediator and the country that is unable to achieve stability in the world. The war in Yemen is another example. Scant coverage of the deaths of hundreds of thousands of Yemenis killed by arms from Western countries, especially the US. Yet the media portrays the real Yemeni army as the aggressor, and the ones doing the bombing as the ones who are following the path of righteousness. More than 1.3 million Ukrainians have fled their homeland so far since the beginning of the conflict with Russia. Countries like Hungary and Poland are being praised for letting in tens of thousands of people, and the EU is preparing measures that would offer temporary residence permits, as well as access to employment and social welfare. But the open-door policy of several states has highlighted an apparent double standard. These refugees can enter some countries more easily than those escaping violence in the Middle East or North Africa. For instance, Poland has welcomed those fleeing the Ukraine war while it pushed back against a wave of immigrants crossing over from Belarus, mostly from the Middle East and Africa, last year. Also, the reporting of this tragedy has seen double standards and Eurocentric bias that hold one group of human lives more valuable than others who are suffering conflicts in countries such as Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Palestine.
But this isn't a place, with all due respect, like Iraq or Afghanistan, that has seen conflict raging for decades. You know, this is a relatively civilized, relatively European, I have to choose those words carefully too, city where you wouldn't expect that or hope that it's going to happen.
This was just one of many remarks on media outlets drawing a line between the conflict unfolding in Ukraine and those in other parts of the world. Many also drew a comparison between Europe's welcoming of Ukrainian refugees and the influx of Syrians, Iraqis, and Afghans, which was declared a migrant crisis. The suffering of refugees from these countries is being played down and almost made to seem that their lives are not as important in comparison to the lives of those fleeing Ukraine. The Western media have been doing a biased reporting of the ongoing crisis in Ukraine. The dehumanization of people of color, of those from countries that are not in the West, needs to stop. More needs to be done to improve for the future of building a united, wider society, which values every single person as a human being.
Russia's decision to attack Ukraine has ushered in a new era in its relations with the West. The United States and its allies are supplying Ukraine with arms and providing it with intelligence to fight Russian troops. But they're not directly involved in the clashes.
The only way to actually implement something like a no-fly zone is to send NATO planes into Ukrainian airspace and to shoot down Russian planes. And that could lead to a full-fledged war in Europe. President Biden has been clear that we are not going to get into a war with Russia.
Of course the U.S. doesn't want that, because if a war breaks out between the West and Russia, the concept of mutually assured destruction will be on the table, meaning that the two sides, both nuclear powers, will be risking total annihilation. To avoid the doomsday scenario, the West has resorted to another form of warfare, the economic type. The United States and many of its allies have announced unprecedented sanctions on Russia, targeting its financial, banking, and oil and gas sector, among others. These include sanctions on Russia's central bank, exclusion of several Russian banks from the SWIFT payment system, and a ban on Russian banks and companies' access to Western capital markets. In other words, Russia's engagement in dollar-denominated business will be severely affected. But let's not forget that for every action, there will be an opposite reaction.
Look, the dominance of the dollar has afforded America great global power, but it is now under real threat as never before, as Russia, China, and others economically challenge the U.S. Many are now seeking to ditch their dependence on the dollar, as Washington has continued to abuse its status as issuer of the world's reserve currency for decades, really, since after the Second World War.
Russia has already been working on plans to reduce its dependence on the trade in the dollar. Russian President Vladimir Putin visited Beijing for the opening of the Winter Olympic Games in China in early February and met with his Chinese counterpart. It was President Xi Jinping's first face-to-face meeting with another head of state in nearly 2 years, which highlights the importance of the visit. The two leaders discussed the need to broaden bilateral trade in national currencies due to the unpredictability surrounding the use of the dollar. Russia has been pursuing the policy for a while. Back in April 2021, the share of Russian exports in dollars fell below 50% for the first time. Moscow's trade with Beijing is mostly responsible for the dive. There's room for improvement, though, as the majority of trade between China and Russia is done in euro, with just over 30% of the transactions conducted in their national currencies. The sweeping sanctions on Russia may push China to speed up measures to break with the U.S. currency and create its own means of payment. The obvious option is the yuan, which is getting stronger than ever. In July, international trade in the Chinese currency set a new record, with many predicting that at this rate, the yuan will become the world's third strongest currency by 2030.
Beijing has been actively encouraging the use of its currency in trade transactions, especially under its massive Belt and Road Initiative, with China recovering more strongly than other big nations after the COVID crisis that we've had. Foreign capital has been flooding in too as Beijing opens its financial markets.
This means only one thing. Given the economic alliance between China and Russia, the sanctions might temporarily hurt Moscow, but in the long run, the West will be disarmed of its economic pressure tool.
Months of intense negotiations in the Austrian capital Vienna to revive the 2015 Iran deal coming to an end. The dialogue faces a make-or-break moment in the coming days. A draft text of an agreement between Iran and the P4+1 group, namely Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany, is almost complete. The diplomatic effort seems to be near a climax, but still the very few remaining gaps in the text are keeping the whole thing in limbo, and a final failure is still a possibility. There has been a flurry of diplomatic efforts in Vienna's Palais Coburg Hotel, the venue of the marathon negotiations. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh said on Thursday that talks between Iran and the P4+1 are still ongoing, and no one can say that an agreement has been reached until all outstanding important issues are resolved. The Iranian foreign ministry spokesman said extra efforts are needed to resolve the remaining issues and that everyone is now focused on the final key steps. Meanwhile, Russia's chief negotiator in Vienna says the talks are unlikely to end in failure. Mikhail Ulyanov told reporters in Vienna on Thursday evening that the remaining issues are few but need to be addressed. Ulyanov's comments were echoed by Britain's chief negotiator in Vienna, Stephanie Alcock, who said the parties are very close to an agreement. The Iranian side insisted that the talks in the Austrian capital have to reach a good deal or there will be no deal at all. Negotiators in Vienna have been trying to find a way to remove American unilateral sanctions against Iran and allow the U.S. to return to the 2015 deal. The U.S. sanctions were imposed after the U.S. unilateral withdrawal from the JCPOA in 2018. U.S. President Joe Biden has acknowledged that his predecessor's pullout was wrong, but Biden's words have done little to solve America's credibility problem that is largely blamed on Donald Trump. Tehran now says the sanctions must be removed in a verifiable manner, and Washington must offer guarantees that it will not abandon the agreement again. The United States has been dragging its feet so far, but Tehran says it will not back down from its red lines.
Iran can't go through the same thing again. I mean, in 2018, the U.S. unilaterally, abrogated the JCPOA, slapped on punitive sanctions. Iran had had 3.5 years of intense economic suffering, and it doesn't want to see that happen again. It doesn't want to sign some treaty. Only to see, to see the same thing happen either in, either later this year or in 2024 when, if Donald Trump is reelected.
Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council Ali Shamkhani has warned that if the Vienna talks do not lead to a good deal, the current U.S. administration will feel defeated in the near future due to lack of timely use of diplomatic opportunities. As all eyes are on the venue of the talks in Vienna, Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Grossi, will visit Tehran on Saturday to hold talks with Iran's nuclear chief and other top officials. The IAEA says the two sides will discuss outstanding safeguards issues with a view to addressing them. Does Grossi's trip boost the chances of a deal in Vienna? It is hard to guess at this point. The negotiations have been very complex, and there is no guarantee that they will end in a deal. It now seems that the fate of the diplomatic effort largely depends on whether the West will finally choose to make necessary political decisions.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kHz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kHz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kHz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترك همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of a speech delivered on February 17, 2022 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with the participation of people from Tabriz and East Azerbaijan, commemorating the anniversary of the Tabriz uprising of February 18, 1978.
Therefore, the goals of the revolution should be kept in sight. And in order to achieve the goals, there are certain needs, some of which are related to the short term, some are related to the present time, and some are related to the future. But preparations for meeting future needs should be made today. We must try to fulfill these needs to the best of our ability. This will bring about the movement of the continuation of the revolution, examples of which I will now present. Now, what are the goals of the revolution? The goals of the revolution are making progress, administering social justice, achieving power for the country, establishing an Islamic society, and ultimately forming the great and new Islamic civilization. These are the goals of the revolution. We must see what we should do to attain these goals. The attainment of social justice, real progress, not fake and shallow progress. Rather, comprehensive progress in worldly and otherworldly areas, the attainment of an Islamic society in which the rules of Islam are completely implemented and the people benefit from the implementation, and the attainment of a new Islamic civilization. Then we should do those things within the scope of our capability. Everyone must do those things to the best of their capability. I, government officials, students, and other such people should carry out those tasks, each in a different way. I will expand on this later on.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
I will cite examples in this regard. The efforts put in by scientists and researchers are a move to continue the revolution. The efforts and teachings of seminary and university scholars, the activities of the entrepreneurs and laborers, including in industry, agriculture, public services, and the like. These are all things that, when done, looking at the goals of the revolution, are examples of the continuation of the revolution. Efforts put in by young researchers, both in universities and Islamic seminaries.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Joint statement by the diplomatic missions of the Western countries in Islamabad has created an uproar in Pakistan. The statement posted on the social media platforms presses Pakistan to condemn Russia. The statement was signed by the envoys of European countries and endorsed by the US Embassy in Islamabad. The move by the Western diplomatic missions here has drawn strong reaction from the Pakistani government. The Foreign Office has summoned the envoys of the Western countries to tell them that issuing public statements against the host country is not in line with the diplomatic protocols. On Sunday, Prime Minister Imran Khan doubled down on the European ambassadors and made it clear that Pakistan is not their slave.
I want to ask the European ambassadors, did you write such a letter to India? What do you think of us? Are we your slaves, that whatever you say, we will do?
Pakistan has maintained a fine balance in the ongoing conflict between Russia and the West over Ukraine. The reason Pakistan refused to condemn Russia stems from its growing ties with Moscow.
But the only thing that I can say from Pakistan's government perspective, that Pakistan wants de-escalation. Honestly, Pakistan wants end of the war or end of bombing or end of aggression anywhere for that matter in the world.
Pakistan has remained in the Western camp for decades, but now wants to diversify its foreign policy options. It was because of this reason that despite pressure from the West, Pakistan abstained from the voting on a resolution against Russia at the UN General Assembly session. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Under the title, the detention of fuel ships is a U.S. decision and our choice is Yemen's hurricane operations, thousands of Yemenis took to the streets of the capital Sana'a and other cities to protest against the Saudi blockade imposed on the country.
The Yemeni people today came out to send a message to the world that they will not sit idle against this stifling siege backed by the US and enforced under the supervision of the UK and members of the Saudi-led coalition. The siege is aimed to bring the Yemenis to their knees.
The protests are taking place amid the worst fuel crisis in Yemen since the beginning of the war, as Saudi Arabia keeps seizing Yemeni oil vessels despite obtaining entry permits by the UN. The long lines of people queuing at fuel stations in the capital Sana'a have reached 4 kilometers for the first time.
The Saudi-led coalition continues to seize Yemeni oil ships amid the silence of the United Nations. Meanwhile, the UN Security Council overlooks the violations of Saudi Arabia and its allies. We call on the international community to look at Yemen as it does with Ukraine and to stand by the millions of Yemenis who have been suffering for 7 years.
Recently, Saudi Arabia tightened the siege it imposes on Yemen and led the war-torn country to a harsh fuel shortage. This has pushed the healthcare system to the verge of collapse, threatening the lives of millions of Yemenis, including children.
Protesters hold the U.S. responsible for supporting the Saudi detention of oil ships, saying Washington is a major partner in the war against their country. They believe that the Yemeni army operations against Emirati and Saudi territories, especially those against Aramco facilities, are the only way to lift the siege. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
In a historic and surprising decision, the European Union has decided to give refugees from war the instant right to live within the bloc and freely travel. They also have the right to work. They even now have rights to housing and medical care. There is one catch. This only applies to Ukrainians. These rights are not being extended to refugees from Palestine, Yemen, Syria, Libya, Afghanistan, Iraq, Mali, the Central African Republic, or any of the other countries in which Western armed interventions provoked refugee crises. Seemingly no one would begrudge Ukrainian refugees their human rights, but many in France are wondering why they are getting treated totally differently from black, brown, and Muslim asylum seekers.
Apparently, you have to be white and Christian to be treated properly by the European Union. That's the sad reality, and it's totally unacceptable. We cannot discriminate according to religion, nationality, or color, which are all things which we don't choose. What we can choose is to be human and to have solidarity with each other.
Drowning by the dozens in Calais, France. Freezing to death in Poland. Packed into camps in Italy, building steel fences, denying basic sanitation, fear-mongering about refugees election after election. The long-running European refugee crisis has taken a new turn, and yet standard European policy remains mostly unchanged. An outcry is growing for the European Union to extend their unity, and many say their humanity, towards non-white refugees.
We have to receive refugees and give them normal, humane conditions, regardless of what continent they come from. We have seen acts towards refugees on the Polish border, and we can't allow such things to happen in France. The government has to treat all refugees with total equality and with urgent measures like proper lodging.
Many say the open discrimination, which reveals a deep racism and xenophobia, as well as an arrogant hypocrisy, will ultimately stain the European Union around the world and at home. Many in the French media are describing Ukrainian refugees as somehow qualitatively superior to other asylum seekers. However, many hope that the European Union realizes soon that all refugees are equal and deserving of dignity, assistance, and the same rights without discrimination. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
When it comes to NATO support and American leadership, we have better ask Afghans. They have the experience of 20 years of Western forces presence in their country. Afghans had counted on Western powers at the beginning, but what the US and its allies really brought for Afghanistan.
Betrayal, definitely. The U.S. and its allies' presence led our country to gallop backward. However, they failed in Afghanistan and ruined our country. We didn't gain anything from dealing with the West except destruction, poverty, and many, many crises.
Sayed Bakir Kazemi was an advisor to the former Afghan president Ashraf Ghani. He believes Ghani's government easily collapsed because he trusted the U.S. and relied on NATO forces.
It is obvious and historically proven that any government or administration that trusted the U.S. or relied on the West ended up with failure and downfall. This experience is repeated in many countries. Former Afghan President Ashraf Ghani did the same mistake and faced a bad downfall.
Some Afghan experts also blame crisis in Ukraine on the U.S., saying nations are falling victim to the U.S. policies of creating war and terror.
The U.S. is using Ukrainians for its own benefits. Western powers don't care about the collapse and destruction of a nation or government. They follow their own devil policies. Afghanistan's experience is repeating in Ukraine. I hope Ukrainians' leaders learn from Afghanistan disaster and crisis ends in their country.
After 20 years of invasion, the U.S. and its allies hastily abandoned Afghanistan in mid-August last year. Today, the country is dealing with the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Afghans are critical of U.S. policies and its legacy on their soil. They consider trusting the U.S. as a big mistake that no country should ever make it. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
British Muslims massed outside Pakistan's High Commission in London, condemning sectarian killings of the country's Shia minority. The vigil comes after a suicide bomber struck inside a Shia Muslim mosque in the northwestern city of Peshawar during Friday prayers last week, killing around 60 worshippers and wounding some 196 people.
The attack may have taken place thousands of miles away, but the pain and hurt that has been felt has resonated across the Muslim world. As you can see behind me, well over 100 people have turned out here today to not only send their thoughts and prayers back to Pakistan, but also to vent their anger and fury at the fact that these types of attacks are still taking place even now.
Daesh claimed responsibility for the attack. The terror group has threatened more violence against Pakistan's Shia. But these worshippers issued strong words of their own.
Shias are like a seed. You bury one and it sprouts out a million more. And they can continue to do whatever they're doing. And I look into their eyes right now and I say, you continue to do what you're doing, but you will never succeed in ending the Shia of Imam Ali, alayhi salam.
We shouldn't have to live in fear that if we go to pray on a Friday, we won't come back. We should know that we're safe and that we're able to do all of this freely. And I want everybody to understand this, that we're taking action because this has happened several times and this needs to stop.
If becoming a creature like you is called being a Muslim, then I think I'm fine with the religion that I stand with. And I think I'm all of these people that are here also stand with me.
Friday's attack was the deadliest in the country since 2018, when 149 people lost their lives, including 9 children, in a terrorist explosion at an election rally in Balochistan. With more than one sectarian terrorist group active in Pakistan, many fear these bloodthirsty bombings will continue to plague Pakistan's religious minorities. Robert Carter, London.
Waiting until the final moment to register in order to skirt laws on equal media time for election candidates, French President Emmanuel Macron confirmed he will run for re-election. The slate of candidates is now finalized. Macron began his term hailed as the new leader of the free world, but his once-in-a-century repression of the Yellow Vests has many calling him a liberal strongman who enforces rubber bullet liberalism. Macron is leading in the first round and has a comfortable lead in the second round of roughly 60-40 over far-right mainstay Marine Le Pen. The Russian special military operation in Ukraine has given Macron a 5-point increase in the past 2 weeks, and the ending of extremely strict coronavirus rules in mid-March may lead to another increase. However, Western polling agencies have become severely discredited in recent years, with France's largest newspaper refusing to run any of them.
I don't believe the polls, which are all conducted by private companies who deliver the results, which they are paid to deliver. Macron's track record is catastrophic. He's achieved nothing for the average person. It's truly the dictatorship of a total capitalist. France has really reached the bottom.
The campaign hasn't been centered around the incumbent's record, but openly Islamophobic ideas. Despite running third or fourth in the polls, far-right convicted racist Eric Zemmour has been allowed by media executives to set the agenda.
The rise of the extreme right is totally unsupportable, and we have no choice but to confront these ideas of fascism, racism and xenophobia. France must stand up as one and say no. I'm sure that France will, and I'm sure no far-right candidate will reach the second round.
The resulting lack of serious issues appears certain to produce record abstention. Just 52% of France is interested in the vote this year, compared to 78% for the previous election.
3 weeks ago, all of the leading candidates were openly pro-Russian, but France's media has been swept by a wave of war hysteria, which usually benefits the incumbent. However, for many, at least that has pushed Islamophobia off the agenda, at least for now. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
On Saturday, over 30,000 people staged a rally in the Italian capital against the escalating war between Russia and Ukraine. The initiative was called by trade unions, leftist groups and pro-peace movements as fighting rages on in a number of Ukrainian cities and talks between Kyiv and Moscow have produced very little so far. The protesters chanted slogans for peace and the end of all wars, urging the United Nations to do more to mediate between Russia, Ukraine and all parties related to the ongoing Ukrainian crisis.
Rather than investing in social welfare, labor, health and education systems, in Western countries have been wasting resources on armaments. Today, Russia must be held accountable for the Ukraine crisis.
Anti-war rallies have been held across Italy over the past days. Most of the demonstrations held in Rome, Palermo, Milan and other Italian cities have been in solidarity with Ukraine.
People at the rally have mixed feelings over who should be held accountable for the war in Ukraine. The majority believe there is a shared responsibility upon all the parts involved, from the US and the NATO, to Russia's president, Vladimir Putin.
In Italy, the most recent government update places the number of Ukrainian refugees who have entered the country since the start of the war at about 9,000. According to Ukrainian-Italian associations, up to 800,000-900,000 refugees may reach Italy in the coming weeks. Max Civili, Rome.
Head of the UN atomic watchdog, Rafael Grossi, was once again in Tehran in less than 3 months to resolve what he called important obstacles in the way of concluding the Vienna talks, which are ongoing between Iran and the P4+1, with the aim of reviving the 2015 deal. In a joint presser, Grossi and head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami, said they agree on a roadmap to resolve all the IAEA questions about Iran's nuclear program by late June.
It's a real pleasure to be back in Iran, in Tehran, and with President Islami, with whom we had a very fruitful and intense exchange this morning.
We have agreed to provide the IAEA by June 21st with documents related to outstanding questions between Tehran and the agency.
The IAEA has been seeking answers from Iran on traces of uranium it has allegedly found in old Iranian nuclear facilities, falling in